Welcome to episode, this is episode five?
Five.
I don't remember. It's been like a...
The one that comes after
five.
Four
five.
Of the Digital Press podcast. Welcome, everybody. Tonight we have a very special episode that is dedicated to our personal recollections and history of the Nintendo Entertainment System. This is an all NES episode of the Digital Press podcast.
What's the
because
NES?
You didn't ask for it, but we're going to do it anyway.
What's the NES?
Oh, shit. That's it.
Yeah.
I had a Master System. Why don't you guys talk about it?
Well, this will be fun. So
I had a Genesis, because it does what Nintendo don't.
Oh.
Well, I have a feeling that this is going to be a really interesting segment, because what we're going to start talking about with the NES is our personal history with the system. Now, some of us bought the NES at launch after maybe what was one of the hardest times of our lives, the video game drought, the crash, the year from around 83 to 84, where there was nobody producing game systems in the United States. Atari had basically gone into hibernation, and Coleco had given up, and the people who were producing the Vectrex were selling those at discount prices at Toys R Us. And there was just nothing. Some of us were continuing to plod along with their Colecos and their Ataris and their Commodore 64s. And then the Nintendo was released, and public consciousness woke back up to video games. So what did you guys... you weren't even born.
No. I'm a youngin. I was born in 1990, so I was born a well...
Wait.
After.
I saw... First of all, how are you still alive? Batman killed you.
Retcon.
It's like, yeah, it's
so
like
we're pulling a Star Wars, okay.
Yeah. So some of us,
Marvel or DC.
Well, Frankie, why don't you start, because
so
you specifically remember the
Yeah, some of us weren't even born, and some of us were alive and you know, enjoying the moment of Nintendo breathing life into the industry. I personally remember... let me start as far back as I can. My earliest recollection of home gaming is my father taking me to a Radio Shack as a kid and saying, "We're getting the car. We're going to buy an Atari." And I was like, "Oh yeah!" And he's like, "You know, Space Invaders, like at the arcade." And I was like, "This is great." So my parents set me up for success or failure, however you want to look at it. At a very early age, they planted the seed of me being a gamer at the youngest possible age in the United States, where Atari started it all. So, and they also graduated me to a Coleco one Christmas. So I was there. I was riding the train, and then, like I said, I experienced the crash firsthand. And I kept playing with my Atari and Coleco, and my parents had bought a Commodore 64. It was our personal home computer. And I was enjoying everything that had to offer. Some of my friends had TRS-80s that they also got from Radio Shack. So there were some games on personal computers, and there was the relics of years before with Atari. And then I had a very well-off friend. His family, you know, was pretty rich, and he invited me over to play at his house one night, and I was interested because he had a lot of Transformers. He had a really big Transformer collection, and I was going to see those. But he said, "Oh, check out this new video game that I got." And it was Nintendo, and, you know, it looked kind of alien. It was more like a big box, and the control pads. At that time, everything was joystick-based. I mean, the Coleco controllers were almost like pads, but they had the telephone keypad, and they're more vertical. But the holding the NES control pad for the first time, you know, it wasn't quite intuitive, but it made sense when you started playing. And he had Castlevania, and he had Super Mario Brothers, which, oddly enough, I had played the Nintendo arcade version of Super Mario Brothers maybe a week or two before. And anybody who's played those Versus cabinets knows that the hardware in those is pretty much exactly like what the home Nintendo experience was. It was like kind of like a Neo Geo, you know, the stuff in those Versus cabinets, which are like kind of like Play Choice. The graphics, the sound, everything was exactly the same. So playing Super Mario Brothers, and he had Super Mario Brothers for the NES. I was like, oh my god, this is like exactly like the arcade game I played last week. There was no divide. There was it was a complete parody. It's not like playing Space Invaders or Asteroids in the arcade and then getting it for the Atari. And you're like, well, this is great, but it's not, you know, or Pac-Man, you know, to the more common reference that people who have Atari 2600s would know. So, yeah, it's, you know.
Best port ever.
But Nintendo, it was like a punch in the face of just brilliance as a kid. And suddenly I was, like, invigorated, and again, I had to have this. However, my parents weren't having it. They had kind of checked out on the video games at that point. I was about 9, I think, at the time, and I went home and I was like, "This is what I want." You know, we did the Atari, we did the Coleco, and they had made a pretty significant investment in the Commodore 64, which I hadn't given up on at that point. It wasn't like I was, you know, I wasn't putting all that in the closet. But they were not prepared to invest in another cartridge game system. So they said to me, if you want a Nintendo, you have to come up with your own means. Like, we're not going to put the, you know, whatever the retail price was at the time. I think it was around $200 for the action set, which just came with Super Mario Brothers. And I wasn't, my friends didn't have Rob, which was a big part of the Nintendo launch, was Rob the Robot with Gyromite. And so my parents were like, you're on your own, kid. And I was like, shit, I really have to have this thing. So
robbed a bank.
Yep. Right? Yep. They still haven't caught me for that, by the way. And I think the statute of limitations is off. Like, even if they did, you know, you can only prosecute that, right? How many years if you don't get prosecuted for a crime?
Well, you were a minor at the time, so there
that
you go.
That too, that too. No, I actually got together. I had a brain trust with a friend of mine at school, and he also knew this rich kid who had the Nintendo, and I was like, look, you know, our friend, he has this. Come over to his house and play with it with me, and when you do, you will see how great it is, and then what we will do is we will go into business together and make enough money to get a Nintendo, and we'll split it. And I swear, it was like, I thought it was the best idea ever. Like, there's no way I'm going to make $200 over the course of it was a winter season. It wasn't even like a summer. We were still in school. Everything was, we were still in session with grammar school. So it wasn't like this was a summer project. We waited in the winter for it to snow. We, like, every snow day, we had our shovels in hand. And we went and knocked on doors in Roseland, New Jersey, and we asked every single person in our entire town if we could shovel their driveway for like $5 each, and it just so happened to be a very snowy winter, and we actually did make enough money after a few weeks of just shoveling driveways to go out and buy NES, and then it was like a divorced family fighting over their children. We're talking like 9 and 10 year old kids coming up on their own without their parents' interaction or approval. Like, we were left to our own devices. We came up with like a system where we had it on alternating weekends. It was equally like enthralling and exciting, and we felt so responsible. But there was like envy and resentment that grew inside of us for each other.
Reminds me of that Simpsons episode where Bart, Martin, and Milhouse bought that Radioactive Man comic.
Yeah. Right? You know what? I think they actually based that on our experience. They were watching us. Because, yeah, and maybe that is a common thing that kids, you know, some kids get into, shared ownership of stuff. But it was fascinating. We bought the NES action set. It came with Super Mario, and we additionally got, I believe, Pro Wrestling 3D World Runner with 3D glasses. So we were way, way ahead of the curve. Mike and his 3D Sony PlayStation display TV. Man, we had 3D World Runner day one. And I think, I can't remember what else we had gotten initially. Maybe Legend of Zelda shortly thereafter. And those games would go back and forth with the system. And I think the shared ownership thing lasted the better part of the year, actually. I think we made it through almost an entire calendar year before my parents asked me if I could ask my friend if they could buy his half out. And I think the kid's parents, as Nintendo was growing in popularity, it was interesting to see our parents kind of come around. Like, at first they were skeptical and they didn't want to invest in it, but after they saw it take a foothold in retail and in the consciousness of America, like Nintendo was becoming a household word, they were like, all right, we appreciate what you did and all the effort you put in, but if your friend wants to give you half of the ownership, sell half of the ownership to you so you're the full owner, we'll pay him the $100 cash. And I think the other kid's parent agreed to it, if I remember. It didn't destroy our friendship or anything. I think he wound up getting his own Nintendo. But it was a really interesting year. I remember seeing things at retail in the glass case, and I swear this is not a false memory. I swear at a Lionel Kitty City in Caldwell, New Jersey, that they had stadium events, the rarest NES game, and that I passed on it. You know, I didn't have a power pad. We didn't buy the power pad system, and I never invested in a power pad. I had one much later in life as a collector, but that game, I was like, oh, you need some power pad thing for it. I'm not going to get that. I got Zelda instead. So, you know, $40,000, you know, I could have, you never.
But at the time, you probably enjoyed Zelda more than you would have.
Yeah, but I would have enjoyed $40,000, on eBay.
Down payment on a house.
You just got to have foresight. You know? So that's my personal recollection of, like, my first experiences with Nintendo was growing up, being a kid, having that first, you know, that first job, like owning something myself that I paid into, and the weird, surreal experience of sharing that with a friend who also bought into it. Who else? Were you?
I was alive, but I was too young at the time. I was a year old when it launched.
Oh, wow.
So my experience with it, I got it when I was probably around four. Something like that. It was probably around like 1988, 1989 when I first got it and I was playing it. My best memory really was, the games, you know, Mario, Zelda, Metroid, you know, Castlevania, Mega Man, all that stuff. But a lot of it really had to do with the culture. The fact that it was more than just the games. Like, it was more than just, you know, sit home, enjoy playing with your friends, things like that. It was just about Nintendo being sort of this phenomenon that was everywhere. You had magazines, you had breakfast cereals, you had TV shows, you know, cartoons like the Mario cartoons, Captain N and all that. You know, it just had, everything was Nintendo. Everything was just about that culture. And sort of seeing that at that age, you know, early, you know, grammar school age, and just sort of experiencing that sort of phenomenon and being part of what's effectively sort of a cultural movement, it just sort of felt special. Like, you know, it just sort of like grabbed me in a way. And I don't know, I just felt like I had to be a part of it.
It's interesting that culture of things that are coined as toyetic or marketed, you know, when things become more than what they are, like you know, He-Man's a toy, but He-Man's also a cartoon,
there
and now
go.
He-Man is a nostalgia icon. And Nintendo has simultaneously, the Nintendo Entertainment System and the games of that era, in the moment, they were what they were. They were the cultural phenomenon. They were not just video games. They became breakfast cereals and plush stuffed animals and packs of stickers and cards and bubble gum and you know, little plastic figurines and lunch boxes, and
McDonald's would have like the Happy Meals.
Exactly, but it's also, but simultaneously become a piece of nostalgia and persisted. Like, we continue to buy the games as Nintendo re-releases the classics. Mm-hmm. We continue to play the NES classics as we get older, either with continued use of the original physical hardware, or through emulation, or, you know, virtual console on Wii, or DS, or 3DS, or whatever. It's just this cyclical. Nintendo are the absolute kings of continuing to sell us the same thing that they've sold us over and over again. And it never really feels as dirty as it does with some other games on some other, you know, like other classics collections, you know. It's
well, you know what it is? I feel like we all have those moments when we're a certain age where, you know, you could be really cynical about it and say impressionable youth, but I like to think about it in more of a positive light where things are new. You know, you just sort of, things are new at a certain age, and you're still feeling your way through the world, and you're just sort of, at some point, you know, like for me also, like in conjunction with video games, Nintendo, it was Superman. I was all into Superman at the time, and it just sort of like, things sort of reflect on you, and you sort of find your...
You played that Superman game for NES?
Yeah. But it's you sort of find yourself in these things. And it's, like, for instance, all, like, you know, those of us who've experienced sort of, like, the 80s cartoons that are effectively just 30-minute commercials, you know?
Yeah, yeah.
That's basically what Nintendo was doing. Everything Nintendo put out was just a commercial for their products. Yeah. But it was done in such a way that sort of felt like more than that, you know? It was more than just a commercial. It was drawing you into not just a world within the video games. It was drawing you into a world and keeping you there because it was everywhere. And you know, it's like, and so when a new TV show came out based on one of your favorite games, all of a sudden that was a big deal. You know, it's like, I play the game, I love the game, but now I get to see it like on television. You know, the characters are talking. You know,
yeah. Yeah.
What's Mario gonna sound like? You know, like what's his voice gonna be like? You know.
Well, excuse me, princess.
Yeah, there you go. You know,
what many of us were disappointed to hear.
I actually wasn't. See, that's the thing.
Yeah, you know, I liked that cartoon when I was a kid.
You know? Oh, good. Link is a big Steve Martin fan. That's good to know. I do remember staying up early on, or getting up early on a Saturday morning to watch those Legend of Zelda cartoons.
And you probably remember, like, the earlier stuff, you know, Pac-Man, you know, Saturday
Super Kid. Oh, sure, the Saturday Super Kid stuff. Yeah, the Saturday morning cartoon. I mean, there's no bigger Dragon's Lair fan here. I watched every episode of the Hanna-Barbera Dragon's Lair cartoon in its original run, and I'm tempted to buy those on DVD. Hanna-Barbera is selling them. Warner, I guess, owns the Hanna properties now. Selling them on demand. You can order them, and they will manufacture, like, burn the DVD with full packaging and everything, but they're not selling them in stores. It's really kind of bizarre.
Oh, yeah, they're doing that for another cartoon that I actually watched as a kid, Pirates of Dark Water.
Yeah,
they're doing it for that, too.
Yeah.
What is it? Manufacture on Demand, I think they call it.
Super NES Pirates of Dark Water.
Yes.
Yeah, it was based on the show.
Yeah. But, yeah, Nintendo was very, very good at licensing a property. I mean, some would say it's a no-brainer. It's easy to do that to flood the market. I mean, and
but they did it so well, and it's like, it's not even. I mean, a lot of people will have things to say about it. They're going to disagree with me completely. But honestly, I don't think that the things that they put out there were very low quality. I really don't. I think that they were appropriate for the demographic. They were appropriate for the time period, and they sort of fit into that whole, like, now you're playing with power kind of, you know, advertising team. Where, like, things were sort of like futuristic, but at the same time accessible.
Definitely. You know? I think we've seen that in the modern era of Nintendo with Pokemon. I think Nintendo does a pretty good job of making sure that the quality of the stuff representing their software, their characters, their licensed properties is pretty okay. You know,
they know their audience.
They do. They do, and they know their audience likes to buy tchotchkes and little toys and stuffed animals and stuff, and you know, and T-shirts with representations. Actually, I didn't buy this. This was Nintendo Points Club. Club Nintendo.
Oh, nice.
You bought it through buying other products.
I bought it through buying Nintendo stuff. I bought it through buying Nintendo games on Wii and DS that I probably have already bought two or three times over on their previous systems. But so, what about you, Gabe?
Actually, I was kind of like you. I was born with an Atari already. It turns out my dad was actually a gamer.
Were you born with an Atari in your
head? Yes, I came out with the Atari. And I actually had a...
That's painful to live
on. Oh, God.
The edges are sharp on the 2600.
My mom is still complaining. My mom is still complaining. She's still complaining. I told her to get over it, but she won't let it go. But actually, I had Donkey Kong on it, so I already had kind of an experience with Mario already.
Yep.
And I was not aware of Nintendo because I was really young when it came out. I was born in 85, around the time of its release, I would think.
Let's think about that, listeners and viewers.
Yeah.
Not knowing about Nintendo. There was a point in time in some of our lives where we did not know. Nintendo was not a word that rolled off the tongue full knowledge of the past. It's like, imagine living in a time before Disney. Like,
yeah, it's weird. It's weird.
It's basically what it is. So, I actually didn't even ask for a Nintendo. My father just came home one day. Hey, Nintendo, new video game system. All right.
Lucky bastard.
Exactly. And that, you know, the sad thing is that trend continued with the Super Nintendo and the Genesis. I had no idea that they were even out there. And he just comes home. Hey, look. New system.
You didn't know the Super Nintendo?
He was
Nintendo
the rich kid.
He was the rich kid you were envying.
In all of our stories, there's the rich kid, all the stuff.
Yeah. See, here's the thing.
Well, story.
I gotta admit, there weren't that many
gamers.
Effectively.
There weren't that many games where I went to school.
I was given the Nintendo early on, and after that, then it was like, I gotta get all these other things. That's when, like, the Super Nintendo Genesis.
Gateway
I was
drive.
Asking for that stuff, you know?
Gateway Drive.
Yeah. Well,
that's exactly what it was. It was a Gateway
Drive. Genesis was like 89. I was 4. So, again, I wasn't aware of these things as they were coming out. And then Super Nintendo was like, what, 91?
Yeah.
So I was going around 6. And at the time, there weren't that many gamers where I lived. It wasn't until after that I became aware of the gamer culture as a whole.
And where was this cave that you lived in?
New York. In Queens.
Really?
Jamaica, Queens.
So was everyone just, like, running down the street with a metal hoop and a stick and, like, a...
It wasn't really a...
There were a bunch of
flowers. A lot of hopscotch.
Yeah. They're playing Red Rover.
Dude, I couldn't even go outside. It was just street. There was nowhere to play.
Well, that's a perfect reason to have an Nintendo.
Exactly.
Stay in the house.
That's why I had it. So the first games that I played on it was... the first game I played specifically, I believe, was Duck Hunt. And, of course, the fucking dog.
Oh, yeah.
The dog. That was my first memory of Nintendo, the dog. So that kind of soured it a little bit for me. But actually, I had the sports set, and that came with the satellite, both of which I still have. I don't have the original Nintendo because they kept dying, you know, the blinking problem. I must have gone through at least 3 of those.
Yeah, in an era where we didn't realize that you could actually clean them and, you know, clean the pins.
Yeah, exactly.
And do some kind of preventative maintenance.
It was the Red Ring of the day.
It was the something of the day, yeah.
Yeah. So I actually went through a few Nintendos. And I actually did not go through some of the bigger titles that most people associate with it. Like, I never played Castlevania around that era. I never played Contra around that time.
Wow.
Or even Mega Man. And the only big titles I played all the Mario games, Mario 1, 2, and 3.
I just want to point out, Nick's in pain
right now. What?
Remember, well, I wasn't the one in charge of the game purchases.
That's true.
My dad was kind of... It was more for him, and I just happened to get to play it.
Your dad had bad taste.
Yeah.
I'm sorry.
I actually grew up... One of my favorite games from when I was a kid, and it's one game that a lot of people hate, Bayou Billy.
I kind of like that game.
I like that game.
That's not bad.
You know what? And a lot of people seem to hate it just because it was hard.
They hate a lot of games at the time.
I hear Mike is a big fan of Bayou Billy. If he was here...
Because... Well,
singing
he's
the praises of Bayou Billy.
Well, isn't he in core right now with Siftio?
Oh yeah, yeah. I heard something about something he was associating the Siftio system with rape and
lawsuits,
libel. There was some libel thing going on. I don't know. Yeah. But then they gave him a free game around the holidays.
I think
everything's okay now.
I hope so.
But Bayou Billy was ambitious, if nothing else. I mean, it had the driving, it had the shooting, and it had the fighting.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not sure if it did any of those exceptionally well.
And it had that funky soundtrack. You got to give it that.
It did have a funky soundtrack, and, you know, you... I just remember you fighting, like, the same two guys over and over again in the beat-em-up section. But, you know, I also kind of remember Mike said he really liked that about it.
I don't think Mike liked it at all, to be honest. I think you're wrong. I think Mike honestly hated Bio-Billy.
Did he?
Whatever. Yeah. It's one of the best games I've ever made.
If he was here. Well, next time we'll ask him about it.
Screw you guys. One of the best games I've ever made. I don't care.
It's like I said, I always thought Bio-Billy was an ambitious title, even if it didn't do everything well.
And an episode of Captain N dedicated to it.
That's how you know. That's how you know.
It did. I'm not kidding.
Well, I think that's Konami, had a lot of... stuff going on.
Actually, what I do remember about Bayou Billy, it kind of tied into the whole cultural thing, was the commercial they had for it, the dude wrestling the alligator. When I was a kid, I thought it was Paul Hogan. Crocodile Dundee.
Kind of was, let's be honest here.
I was like, oh.
You thought an Australian guy was a Creole guy who's...
I never actually heard the commercial. I only saw it. So I was like, oh, it's Paul Hogan, Crocodile Dundee.
It's a guy and an alligator. Yeah, it must be Crocodile Dundee. A guy with a Bowie knife and an alligator.
He's got the hat. He's got the hat. So, of course, years later, I look up the commercial on YouTube, and I'm like, yeah, that's not Paul
Hogan. Although, it was Fabio on the cover of Wizards and Warriors 2, Iron Sword.
So you
were right about that.
I was right about something.
When you bought Wizards and Warriors 2, and you were like, is this Fabio? I think it's Fabio.
Who is that man in that hair? My God.
You know that part in the game where the character jumps up and down and says that he can't believe it's not Fabio? I'm pretty sure it's Fabio.
It was definitely Fabio. So, I didn't play the heavy hitters.
I'm sure there's a copy of Wizards and Warriors too. Here.
You know what there has been for the longest time?
Well, there's a copy of Lethal Weapon. That's good enough for me.
No, let's avoid having Mel Gibson.
Here's your Noid.
Wait, isn't that it down there?
Avoid the Noid?
Right there? Iron Sword? I think that is.
Yeah.
There you go.
For those of you who... I'll make this as easy as possible. Cameraman.
We see it's Fabio.
There it is.
It's fun.
It certainly is.
The ladies are now excited.
Best part of the podcast.
So Michael Rosenbaum. Let's zoom in on that face.
You know, I hear Mike's voice from somewhere off set. So now,
we should probably put that back.
Yeah, points for maintaining the alphabetical order of the store's NES collection.
I just
threw it onto the top of R.
I know, it's your first
the
day.
The customer was looking for Iron Sword, would have never found it if you hadn't put it back.
Yeah, exactly. So now someone can come in and get Fabio.
Really hair.
Yes.
That's the system we use here to control.
Well, you're the employee. You're the star employee.
I'm the insider.
I did not play the heavy hitters back in the day, and I actually didn't play Contra until around last year, actually. I did not play and beat Contra until 2011. But I did it on original hardware.
Wow, that's pretty interesting. Did you use the 30 lives code?
The first time, yes. After I learned how to play the game, I actually got pretty good at it. I was able to do it without the code and Super C as well.
I love Super C. I think Super Contra is really underrated. And I must admit, though, I do prefer the arcade version of both of those games to the NES one. But they're good on Nintendo. They're a lot of fun.
Take a roll.
Nope.
He's making weird signals.
He is. I have no clue that he's signing, but he's...
Mike's very excited off camera.
Oh, boy. Anyway, so obviously...
What about you? Yeah.
Yeah,
born in 1990.
The young fang, if you will. Obviously, I wasn't around when that came out, but my parents are big gamers, so I had, when I was born, there was already 2600 and NES in the house. And so I spent a lot of time on the NES more than the 2600. And my first real memory of playing, of just the farthest back I can remember playing a game, is I was playing Dragon Warrior, and that was one of the games I really got into. I really liked the role-playing games. And so I loaded up my brother's save file, and I went all the way to the Dragon Lord at the end of the game, where he asks you if you want to join him or if you're going to defy him. And I was like, I'll join him. And when you get to that point, if you choose yes, it's an instant death. And the game just freezes, and the text turns like red, which happens when you die in the game. And I got scared. I was like, oh no, like, what did I do? And that was, you know, obviously the game was still fine.
Did you run and tell your parents?
Yes.
Yes, I joined the Dragon Lord!
He's coming to get me!
And then later on, I accidentally erased my brother's save file before he beat the game.
Oh.
Oops.
Oopsies.
Oops. That happened, but.
Like a mortal sin.
Yeah, he wasn't happy. But I mean, I had so many good memories just playing the NES when I was growing up. Obviously, Dragon Warrior, that was the first game I really sunk a lot of time into. My parents did buy a lot of the really like heavy hitter games. We put them so like Mega Man 1-6. I had all those, and that was really
you son of a bitch.
That was really like the games that the Mega Man series. That was my big thing when I was growing up. That I would play those. And I never had a Super Nintendo. Never got a Genesis either. So I just stuck with the NES until the N64 came out. So there are like memories of just the three big things that stick out in my memory of the NES are that moment. It's just all of Dragon Warrior sticks out to me. I love that game start to finish. Playing about every weekend, my brother and I would try and get through Battletoads. And one weekend, we finally got through the entire game, start to finish, in one sitting. And I've not been able to do that since. That skill has completely just left my mind.
Isn't that amazing what you could do?
that Nintendo era.
The Nintendo
of games.
Heart.
Yeah, where, you know, the longevity of some of these games was just the fact that they were so hard to play and so hard to beat some of them. And we didn't, there was no internet for us to reflect on, like, a public opinion. So if you weren't good at, like, Ghosts and Goblins on Nintendo, you couldn't go on the web and see a million other people in a comment section on a website going like, oh, that fucking game sucks, it's too hard. And like, your opinion wasn't affected by that. You were like, I must not be good at this. I have to keep trying.
Yeah.
I'm gonna get better. I'm gonna beat this game. It's not gonna beat me. And you know, so that's kind of gone away with the passage of time, where now a really hard game, if it's not a really well designed game and it's hard and there's flaws in it, you scratch your head a little bit and you go on the internet and go like, okay, what's the other people think of this? What does the rest of the world say about this game?
Plus, when you're a kid, I mean, you had limited resources, you know. If you had a game that you couldn't beat, that's the game you stuck with, because, you know, these days...
Yeah, that's all you got. Yeah,
I mean, it's different, you know.
It's why a new game that games, you can have
yeah,
if you
want to play. It meant more at the time.
Yeah.
You know, because today, you know, you buy a game and it's like, you know, play a week, it's like... Fucking thing sucks. You get something else, you know.
Trade it in, get a new one.
You know. You know.
Yeah, definitely. It's definitely a... And the release cycles. Nintendo purposely didn't allow companies to license more than two or three games during a sales quarter. Mm-hmm. So, you know...
Ultra Konami had to.
Yeah. I mean, and Nintendo didn't always do that, but I mean, you got your Mega Man 2. If you played through the whole game, you got home, bought it that day, and played it all day, and beat it at the end of the night. You're like, oh damn! Now what the hell do I do for that? You know,
play it again.
Yeah, you can do that, but there's definitely something to be said about savoring the moment on the games that were a little too easy.
Yeah.
And the ones that were a little too hard, you know...
I think that's why I like the Mega Man games such, because they were a real challenge. And I could play through them over and over and over, try to find ways to, you know, maybe I won't die here, stuff like that, maybe I'll be able to get the game without using it to continue, something like that. But it was fun, because I could keep playing those over. I could play 1 through 6, and then I'll start back at 1. Or yeah. I could play something else.
Mm-hmm. Well, a lot of the Capcom stuff on Nintendo that had that quality to it. You know, I recall doing that not just with Mega Man games, but DuckTales on Nintendo. I beat that one countless times.
Little Nemo.
Yeah, tried to you know, best my own speed runs. And I mean, like, or it's cool with Nintendo seeing things happen in our lives, like, organically. Like, did any of you guys do, like, speed runs? Like, say, like, I'm going to sit down and see if I can beat Mega Man 2 in one sitting. Like,
I did that with
no passwords, you know, just go right through.
I think one of the first games that I ever sat down and I said, like, you know what? Because I play this game so many times, I'm going to sit here, and I'm not going to stop until I do it, was Chip 'n Dale. That's another Capcom game.
Yep.
That was one of the games that, but, I mean, because it was two-player co-op, me and a friend of mine were like, it was one of those times when, like, you're like, you know what, we have the afternoon free, Saturday afternoon, we're going to sit here, we're going to start the game, and we're not going to stop until we beat every level. You know, and you don't have to play every level in that
right.
game, but we're like, you know what, we're playing every level. And that was, it was one of those moments. Another one was Legendary Wings, another Capcom game, did with my cousin. You know, we were, you know, playing through that. And it was just sort of those moments where, you know, you had nothing else to do. So you're chilling with your friends. Yeah. That's what it was about, you know?
Yeah, the birth of, you know, really great two-player cooperative mm-hmm. games also. I mean, most of the two-player stuff in the earlier systems was competitive, but... Nintendo gave us a lot of cooperative play stuff. Oh, here's a great recollection as a kid. my grandmother took me to a toy store, you know, pick out a couple of Nintendo games. I bought Bionic Commando, which was a great NES game, even though different than the arcade version, but it was one of those ones that was just Capcom at their finest on Nintendo, building a game specifically for the qualities of that system. Great game, one of my favorites, but I also picked out Golgo 13, which maybe not the greatest game ever made, but I recall going home, playing a little bit of Bionic Commando, saying, okay, this is great, and then putting in Golgo 13, and my parents were in the room as I was playing, and it gets to the implied sex scene, And I felt so, like, scared and guilty and dirty, like, oh no, are they watching? Was that, did the character just have sex with a girl? Did they go to bed? Like, there's, like, a little silhouette, and they lie down, and it goes dark, and it's, like, I felt so, like, dirty. And I was really concerned that my parents and my grandparents who were there had, like, full understanding of what was going on the screen. But I think because it was a video game, it was like the teacher in Charlie Brown to them. It was like, wah, 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 wah. They were like, ah, oh, stuff's going on the screen. And then, of course, I told my friends the next day, like, I got this game, and there's a sex scene. It's a Nintendo, and there's a sex scene.
Best game ever.
Yeah, for that moment in time, it was the best game ever.
And several more boys hit PMG after that.
That's another interesting point you bring up. That at the time, like, my parents were the same way. You know, it started with the NES, and to this day, they still don't know what the hell anything's about. You know, no, I'm serious. Like, you know, like,
literally
yeah,
anything.
Yeah, it's like, you know, where it was sort of for you. It's like, yeah, you were playing games. Like, your parents, you know, they sort of like just let it go. It's a toy. You know, it's like they don't know what it's about, and you know what it's about. They don't know what it's about, and it's sort of, I don't know.
Did you ever have a moment with, like, your mom or your dad where, even though they had that mindset, where you get them, sit down, or they do it on their own, they pick up something like Tetris or Punch-Out or anything, and, like, go, like, and you catch them playing it, like, oh, look, mom's playing, like, Tetris, and she's...
My mother liked Duck Hunt. She did like Duck Hunt, but that was pretty much about it. My parents, they took a passing interest in the fact, like, they liked that I liked it, mm-hmm. but... And they, you know, like, if I was playing, I got really excited about it. I go, yeah, that's good. You know, like, you know, and everything like that.
But he's going to be a competitive gamer. Yeah. Lots of money.
But it was like, it was just sort of like, if I was playing a game, I was playing a game. They didn't care what game it was. Yeah. They really didn't pay much attention to what it was about. And it was just, I mean, you know, but, and I felt that it allowed a certain level of freedom that I kind of enjoyed. It was sort of like, that was my thing. And I think that's a big deal for a kid when you're like 6, 7, 8, 9 years old.
Yeah.
When it's something for you, you know. It's not like you're, it's not where you're tethered to your family or anything like that. It's something where you can feel,
I mean, a sense of ownership, yeah, a sense of self.
There you go.
You know what anyone else you're feeling from those video games.
Yeah, when you walked in, your mom was playing Duck Hunt, did you walk up and smack the out of her
get
hand?
Off that.
It's my Duck Hunt.
What are you doing?
Could you
get
her with the gun?
All right. So
pull the trigger.
On that note, on to our next segment. So now, let's talk about what it means to be an NES, not just a Nintendo.
What it means to be an NES.
Yeah, small,
what does
square,
it feel like?
Gray box.
Some of us are top loaders.
I blink on and off frequently until people blow into me. then I'm fine for like a day. But then you have to blow me again.
You went for the easy joke.
Yeah.
So in other words, you're a pig.
Lazy.
I don't write
this. Shut up, Dead Suit
Mike.
Yes,
you do.
What does it mean to be an NES, Nintendo Entertainment System, fan or collector or enthusiast in this modern era? Now, I'm not talking about being a Nintendo fan or Nintendo fanboy or whatever you want to call it. I'm talking about specifically reveling in, enjoying, being a historian of, being an enthusiast of, the NES and that 8-bit Nintendo era of hardware. And you've got a lot of options in this day and age.
Oh, yeah. Well, I mean, on one level, and probably the, for me, it's, oh, cool, I get a chance to play all the games that I always wanted to play that my parents wouldn't buy me. So,
exactly
that aspect to it, where it's like, oh, well, I've always heard about this game, but I never got to play it, so let me check it out, either through emulation or through, obviously, I work at a store so I can...
Like this.
Copies there. Exactly. Like I can play Rockin' Ball.
Rockin'.
I don't want to, though. But if I wanted to play
Rockin'
Ball...
You do want to play Rockin' Ball.
I don't want to play Rockin' Ball. Disclaimer, Nick does not want to play Rockin' Ball.
Rockin' Ball rocks.
Oh, it doesn't.
Can you play Rockin' Ball with the Rock and Roller controller?
I don't know.
You should try it. This was a marriage made in heaven. Rock and Ball and the Rock and Roller controller.
Were they released?
With the Rollin' Rock beer in hand.
Yes. Oh, my God. That would be awesome. Although, yes, I think James Rolfe probably has already done that in one of his videos.
Damn you.
Damn you, you're James Rolfe and all your success.
Nerd!
Yeah, that is cool now that the entire library is more accessible than it was back then. I mean, the games aren't $40, $50 a piece now. You can, you know, some of them pennies on the dollar. You can buy lots. You can go garage sale picking. And that's kind of dried up a bit in 2012. But there's still people out there.
I don't know, man. I mean, I've always wanted to play stadium events, and I hear that one's a little hard to get.
I bought a copy. I opened it. It was pretty good.
Oh, okay, sure. Cool.
I found a sealed one at a garage sale. It's just, yeah, I took it home.
Well, okay. Sold the GameStop.
Is it as good as they say?
Eh.
Oh. All right. Well, I guess I'm not missing anything.
I threw it out.
Yeah. Guess I'm not missing anything then.
No.
All right.
Clearly.
On to the Nintendo World Championship then.
Sucks.
But you've got a lot of options, and being a Nintendo fan, you can have a library of physical cartridges, and you don't even have to buy original NES hardware, because as most of us know, the front loading toaster style NESs barely worked well in the late 80s when they were released. They had massive issues with the 72 pin connectors inside that would, you know, make a connection with the cartridge and send all the information to the CPU. If just one of those pins didn't read right, if it had a little bit of oxidation or dirt or whatever, you know, I've seen all kinds of theories floated. If the connection's not perfect, the system would flash on and off.
But isn't that because it triggers like the NES 10?
Yeah, that's a big part of it. The lockout chip, the security chip that Nintendo put in there to prevent like games that were not licensed, and that's a whole interesting story about how Nintendo put a lockout chip with an algorithm in it that ran in these cycles, and there Atari, who was releasing games under Tengen at the time. For Nintendo, those are unlicensed cartridges, and they actually got around that lockout chip by it. Those carts actually zap the lockout chip. It sends some kind of signal to it before the Nintendo even boots up, in that millisecond before it powers up and reads the chip, that like kind of paralyzes that chip. And Tengen actually figured out the way that chip worked by...
Didn't they call the patent office?
Yeah, they contacted the patent office, which had all the schematics and all the documentation, and it was just a major, like, crazy loophole that they got through. And
like, hey, can you give us this information? It's like, yeah, no problem.
Social engineering. Didn't they have licensed games at one point on Nintendo?
Yes, they did.
Was the furor over, Tetris or Pac-Man?
Tetris. It was RBI Baseball, and Tetris, Gauntlet, and Pac-Man were all licensed releases. Well, no, Tetris was never a licensed release, but RBI Baseball, Gauntlet, and Pac-Man were all licensed releases through Tengen on Nintendo, and I believe that when it got to Tetris, things got really funky, because the guy who invented Tetris didn't even own the rights to Tetris. He was living in he was a part of the Soviet Union at the time, and the communist government owned everything. So Atari, IBM, and Nintendo all went to the Soviet Union. They all Bulletproof Software, and they all went to that Soviet Russia, and they all were vying for the license to be able to bring this incredibly popular puzzle game to their systems, and the Soviet Union kind of sold them all the rights. You get the rights. Das Vedanya! Everybody drink and do a Russian dance.
What do you mean only one company holds the rights in your capitalist country?
It was, you know, and
he's giving missiles away. You know?
It was kind of crazy, and the best. I'm not doing this story justice at all, and I'm sure there are people watching and listening now that are shaking their fists at their computer, like, no, that's not exactly how it went. It was like this. Read the book Game Over. That will give you the best documentation of what exactly went on. in that whole scenario, and it was just, oh my god, it's fantastic. It's such a well... it sounds like something that someone would write for a Hollywood movie. Like, it just sounds like fiction, but it's just...
Well, because there's a lot of, like, black backroom kind of, like, dealing, kind of, and there's a lot of, like, sleazy business involved.
There's a lot of sleazy business in the early days of the NES, because Nintendo was very concerned about not hitting the same pitfalls and making the same mistakes that Atari did with oversaturation of poor quality products. So they tried to really keep a stranglehold on how many games the company could release and instill this notion that, you know, the games must be of a certain mark of quality, the seal of quality, the Nintendo seal of quality, which is basically a pay licensing program. Like, you just had to pay through the nose to be able to get Nintendo to license and allow you to be distributed under their licensed banner. And all these things are really fascinating business that has kind of carried on into the modern era of game systems and publishers and license. Hey, do we have a caller?
We have a caller.
Hey, you guys got Modern Warfare 3?
Caller, go.
Hello, I have a question for your staff.
Yes, what would that be?
I have a young son. He's only 39. And I would like to know if he was not a fan of Mario, what sort of game might he play on the Nintendo Entertainment System?
Iron Sword.
Well, by saying he's not a fan of Mario, do you mean he doesn't like games where the characters run and jump and throw things?
No, he loves jumping and throwing. He throws all the time.
our colleague, Mike, has made a special recommendation
Of Silent Service.
Yes, and Silent Service, from what I've heard, is one of the rarest and hardest to find NES cartridges on the market. It's almost impossible to find one in the wild, and at gaming conventions, there's never any Silent Service cartridges left at the end of the day when people are buying Nintendo games at a discounted price.
Now, young man, I have Silent Service already. I'm looking for a game for my young son.
Barbie.
Top Gun, I hear there's nothing more satisfying than landing the plane.
You sound like a very attractive woman. Are you married?
Hello. You offend her, Frank.
We've lost her. Well, that was an exciting moment of a live caller on the Digital Press podcast. And maybe a herald of needing to move on topically to being an NES collector and enthusiast in the modern era. Like I was saying, you could own a collection of physical NES cartridges, and you don't actually have to have an actual original NES hardware. There are companies now in China and also in China that are manufacturing clone systems, which to me, I'm a clone enthusiast. I think they're really cool. They don't always work perfectly, and there's always something about them that's just not quite right, but they're built from the ground up on emulated version of the CPU of the Nintendo, so it's like they kind of backwards engineered how the Nintendo originally worked, but they make sure not to include any copyrighted software code or hardware in there, so they can produce these things and they'll play the Nintendo cartridge, but they're not made by Nintendo. And typically, they're more functional in terms of reading the games and not having the problems that the original NES hardware had. And they've become more and more popular. They've become more, I don't know if accepted is the right word, but more commonplace, to a point where you can walk into almost any non-traditional, non-GameStop type game store, like like Digital Press. If you come to Digital Press in Clifton, New Jersey, you can buy a clone system like the Retron 3, which will play Nintendo, Genesis, and Super Nintendo games, or a portable Nintendo that looks like a Game Boy, but it only plays Nintendo cartridges.
And the FC Mobile.
FC Mobile, yeah. Too.
As somebody who doesn't know a whole lot about clone hardware, I've always been sort of like an authentic junkie. I shouldn't call myself an authentic junkie, but okay. But
well, you do a lot of, you do smoke a lot of crack.
Yeah.
So. This is an intervention, Mike.
Yeah.
Surprise.
Well, for somebody who knows about the clone hardware like you do, mm-hmm. what would you say are the limitations of them?
You bring up a good question. When you first buy a clone system, most people's first experience with buying a clone system, you see it and you're like, oh, this is great. It's gonna, it's a Nintendo and it's gonna work better and it's smaller and maybe it has audio video composite outputs that the original Nintendo maybe could only hook up with an RF, so you can plug it into your modern system, and you get all excited and you get home and you start putting the games in and you notice the sound. Emulation is not exactly right. Like maybe the pitch or tone of certain sounds and the music in certain games isn't quite right. And it's not like it's broken. It's not that it doesn't work. It just sounds a little different than you remember it. That Zelda music sounds a little bit flatter than you remember it. Or the colors, maybe a color is off here and there. So there's always something that's just left of center. Mm-hmm. But if you're going in with the right expectations and you're not expecting it to be 110% perfect, exactly like your Nintendo system, you typically come away with something that is much more reliable in terms of its functionality. Most of them now come with ports where they'll take the real NES control pads. You can, if you have an actual authentic Nintendo controller, you can plug that in. It has that 9-pin NES setup. And they'll work. You know, but the people who go in with their expectations too high will sometimes come out disappointed in the way that the sound... I think sound is typically the biggest drawback. And then there's some games that won't work at all.
I heard Castlevania 3 is a tough one to get working on a lot of these.
Castlevania 3 for a long time was like a holy grail of the clone system cartridges. But there are some that have emulated the software or gotten their software in their clone systems working. Some manufacturers, that is, that make these clone systems have nailed that. They figured out Castlevania 3 because that has extra chips and extra hardware in the actual cartridge. That's just too big and runs too, you know, complexly for these clones that emulate the Nintendo hardware in a very basic way. And then, do you guys have clone systems? Do you have one?
I actually don't have any. I don't have a clone system.
I have like a weird, I have like just a mountainous collection. I'll, you know, if I'm somewhere, if I'm in like one of those Morning Glory stores and they have like an odd clone system that's shaped like a plastic penguin or something. believe me, they're in the most...
Have one of those.
Yeah, bizarre shapes and sizes. You'll get ones that look like a PlayStation 2 or an Xbox or, you know, but the cartridge slot will be for like a Famicom or an NES cartridge, and it's so bizarre that even though it essentially does the same thing as all the other clone systems I own, there's something in my DNA that's just compelled to
get it.
Yeah, and especially if it's cheap, if it's like 15 or 20 bucks.
Do you get those clone systems that have games built in?
Most of them do.
Did you ever get the one that Walmart had?
Was it actual? Did it actually have NES games on it, or were they like kind of reformatted NES games where they took the sprites and they...
No, it was actually NES games for the most part. It was 151 games in it, and a good chunk of them were authentic NES games.
Like unaltered?
Unaltered. So in other words, these guys probably never got the proper license because not too long afterward, Walmart pulled those things from the shelves, but it was only going for something like $20 or $40.
Yeah. There was a couple of years where like every shopping mall in New Jersey had a kiosk run by like a couple Greek guys.
Yeah.
That, oh, I remember that. It looked like an N64 controller.
Yeah, the N64. Yeah. The Super Joy controllers.
Yes, and I remember that.
I see those all the time at the flea market.
Yeah. Those are surprisingly good. They have, you know, about 100 games in them, or maybe 40 or 60, depending on which ones you're getting. And the games look and sound good. The ones that have the games built in on the chip, most of the times they don't have a cartridge input on the back, the Super Joy ones. But yeah. Some of them do. Some of them actually have a full NES cartridge slot, so you can put, like, a giant NES cartridge. Mario, is that you? You can put a full cartridge in the bottom, and then
you're tiny.
Play. Yeah,
very good.
It's the Ghost of Mario.
Rest is East Mario.
Yep.
I mean,
so yeah, clones is, and then we can emulate. That's another aspect of being an NES player enthusiast in this day and age is you can download any number of NES emulators for your computer, for your, you know, jailbroken iPhones and iPads. You can download
your modded PSP.
Your modded PSP, your modded Xbox 360, your modded PS3.
I think it's like the first
your
thing
droid that you
like,
don't
like,
have to jailbreak.
Something.
Yes, you're, yes.
They get an NES emulator running on it. That's the first thing that happens whenever some like gaming device gets hacked.
That's always proof of concept.
Yeah, it is. At this point, it's interesting that NES emulation is essentially the first thing that hackers and emulators go to. Maybe it's so rudimentary. Maybe there's so much foundational groundwork having been done by other past hackers and emulators that it's just like,
well, it's like the
a rite of passage. Yeah.
It's like the perfect storm. It's people know how to do it, and it's got the widest appeal. So, you know, that's what gets people to start using the homebrew stuff in the first place. You know, that's again a gateway drug.
Yeah, it's always fun to see like the Nintendo stuff, you know, continue to be iterated on all of these. Like here's Super Mario on an iPad, or here's Super Mario on, you know, whatever. I'm sure the PlayStation Vita, when that comes out and is hacked within the first month,
mercilessly hacked.
There'll be like, you know, NES emulators on that utilize the touch screens and stuff. Like, oh look, I'm playing Duck Hunt, like, and I'm poking the ducks instead of using a light gun. Touching the screen.
Suck it, duck!
The easiest game ever.
So emulation is a big part of it, and then the Nintendo continues to sell us our favorites. Our favorite NES games are Super Mario, Super Mario 2, Super Mario 3, Zelda. Mm-hmm. You know, they repackage them sometimes in what some would call very stingy, like, collections of maybe, like, two or three games. Like,
and they still buy them, though. That's the way it works, you know?
That Mario All-Stars ROM on the disc.
That's Super Nintendo.
Right.
And this is about NES.
But that didn't even come with... No, those were the Nintendo games, though.
No, it was the Super Mario All-Stars.
It's a Super Mario.
Right, but it was the Super Nintendo.
It was a remake.
Super Nintendo.
But it was the Nintendo games.
Yeah. I mean, but...
But the packaging was nice.
But there's something to be said about, like, going back to what you said in the beginning about Nintendo having a certain standard of quality. A company like Capcom, if they're going to give us a classics collection, somehow we've come to a point where we kind of expect 20 or 30 games maybe in that collection, like, if they're going to charge 20 or 30 bucks for it. Or even in the Sega Genesis collections we've seen on modern consoles, people love Sonic as much as they love Mario. You know, talk about a rivalry for the ages. Yeah. But when you buy a Sega Genesis collection, you're going to pay 20 bucks. Man, I really hope it has like at least 20 or 30 games on it. You know, I'm getting a game about a buck a game. But Nintendo can charge us 20 or 30 bucks and sometimes only give us two or three games. And there's that synonymous, like, it's that Disney thing where like, yeah, well, we charge you that much because the quality of our stuff is so high, and because they've always...
It's going to go back in the vault.
Yeah.
It's going to go back in the vault.
They've done it, and they have always kept their prices. Talk about a company that doesn't drop the price.
Yeah.
You know, you get the greatest hit stuff on Nintendo systems, like, during the final year of that system being produced and sold, typically, and...
Well, again, it goes back to the fact that they know people have an emotional attachment to these characters and these games. You know, they know people always want to revisit Mario. They know they always want to revisit Zelda, Metroid, and all that. So the idea that because it's sort of what people grew up with and what they feel so attached to, you got them by the balls. You know, what are you going to say? You know,
in some ways, they're like the most profit-oriented company because they're the only ones that always make profit from their hardware. They don't drop the prices of their games for the longest. Like, New Super Mario Bros. Is still $40, I think, right?
I'm sure it is, yeah. I mean, it is definitely a hallmark of Nintendo. And, you know, it's that very traditional Japanese mentality, I think. And they are a Japanese company through and through. No matter how entrenched they've become in the American culture and the American consciousness, they are a proud, you know, they are a proud samurai. Nintendo. Yeah. They definitely will never, very rarely show us their humble side. You know, the 3DS being a rare exception in this modern era of them apologizing for maybe overestimating what the public is ready to pay or willing to pay for something like that, but we certainly never got anything like that in the NES era. They were confident and enthusiastic about the quality of their stuff and the price that they were asking all the way up to the very end. We really didn't see much reduction in price in NES hardware up until the twilight years, the very, very end. When we also got the best hardware from Nintendo, the top loader NES.
Well, that might be debatable too, though, because
it doesn't have AVL. But the Japanese version does, and who knows why.
Was that a cost-cutting strategy? I don't even know what that was about.
I don't know.
It's probably how much they hate America.
Now buy our shit.
When you buy the top-loading NES, the terrorists win. for those of you who don't know, Nintendo, the Toaster NES, the front-loading square classic NES that most of us are familiar with, was their flagship system for many, many years. And then in the same year that they released the Super NES, which I believe was
91.
Yeah, I believe it was 91. They also gave us a top-loading, similar in style to Super NES, a top-loading NES 2, which had a much, much, much more reliable set of contact pins in it, and no mechanism, no moving mechanism that you put the cartridge in, and it's nice and small, and it's a favorite of many Nintendo enthusiasts. And it's a big part of being a modern NES collector. If you don't own a top loader NES in this day and age, you know, you're probably, I don't know.
Yeah.
We don't like you. Yeah. You shouldn't be on this podcast anymore.
Like
you
said, we're the only one here who actually has one.
Yeah, I don't have one.
Really?
No. Yeah, how about you? I just changed
my
pin. How about you get the hell out of the podcast?
I have one.
Yeah. Well,
you're dead to us, Mike.
Yeah. Well, I guess
maybe
I'm,
you're
I
the
guess
one
I'm
that
special.
Should leave. Maybe you should leave.
Maybe.
Oh, show.
Oh, snap.
Well, you guys should get your hands on a top loader. And yes, it's definitely worth it if you're into pulling out the classic hardware.
They were raffling one away at MAGFest, along with an SNES and a Genesis. I did not win. It's a good raffle, only $5 for a ticket.
Damn. So we talked about being a modern NES. What do you guys... To you, what is it to be an NES enthusiast in this modern era?
I'm always in awe of the amount of love and devotion that it gets from people. And you see it in all kinds of ways. We just talked about how the fact that an NES emulator is always the first thing to show up. We talk about, you know, there are ROM hacks, all kinds of things.
Did you play as a Bobo's Big Adventure?
Oh my god.
Talk about a love letter to the era of Nintendo Entertainment System. Not to sidetrack you, but everybody should when you're done listening to this podcast, don't turn us off now, because I'll be very mad at you. Look up Bobo's Big Adventure. You can play it on Newgrounds, or it's got its own website. In fact, I found on my computer anyway, it ran better on its own website without all the ads and stuff from Newgrounds populating the screen. It's one of those flash games similar to Super Mario Crossover where they like co-opted every NES character that you can think of, and it's like a Double Dragon type game, but you play as a Bobo from Double Dragon, and Oh, it's great. But
oh, so it's like the,
but so in the Super vein of Super Mario crossover, the yeah. fact that people just yeah. love the NES so much that they put their effort into it, into just making these games that are just sort of homages to, you know, to this era, and just everything about it. The fact that we see, I think I'm gonna venture a guess that NES probably has the most number of collectors, maybe second to the Atari, maybe, you know. It certainly is the system that has some of the most pricey games, you know, some of the priciest
well,
games
yeah,
are Nintendo in some ways, which is...
Stadium Events yeah. is on record as being the highest value sold yeah. game of that on eBay. Is it still, is that 40? Was that 40,000?
It's either that or Nintendo World cartridge, so either way, yeah, it's... I
mean, the Nintendo World Championship cartridge.
Yeah. I mean, you know, they were selling online, on the internet, they're selling an NES for $13,000?
The NES 001?
Yes, the NES 001.
It's worth $13,000. I hear you can find those in storage lockers.
Yeah. Yeah.
I saw that episode.
I felt so bad for him too, though.
When he's like, the guy's like, it's worth about $10. The guy in the store when he went to.
I read that one of these things sold online for $13,000. Yeah.
I didn't feel too bad.
This is the first Nintendo DS they ever made.
Yeah, the guy was a bit of a character.
That's it, perfect.
Yeah. He was a bit of a character, but
that's your dad, isn't it?
It was fun.
Shut it.
But yeah, so I mean, just the fact that it never seems to slow. It always, if anything, it just keeps speeding up. Just keeps speeding up because there's always.
Well, thanks in part to yeah. Nintendo continuing to perpetuate their. Yeah. Because you know, they
also
a they know there's money to be made mm-hmm. and b. You know, they are definitely proud of their history. I mean, talk about a company mm-hmm. that's always happy to look back on their, you know, 15, 20, 25, 30-year anniversaries mm-hmm. of, you know, I'm sure we're going to get a 30th anniversary edition of mm-hmm. Zelda or Mario or all their great mm-hmm. franchise titles.
I just feel like looking back on it to this day and having access to so many games that I didn't have access to back in the day that... Again, I'm just so in awe by the fact that the NES has some games that are just so fantastic, but there are so many games that barely function as well.
Oh god.
So many games just barely function. Yeah. They don't like
have,
they just plain don't work.
Talk yeah. about and emulators.
And
yeah. Just, get a full and, set of NES
yeah,
games.
It's just really just... amazing to just see what it was like. Like these are games that the math didn't work. You know what I mean? Like they just didn't work yeah. in some ways.
It's
in some cases,
fascinating.
And exactly, and it fascinates me that the games that were so good were just so good that everybody just grabbed onto it. They fell in love with it, and it's still going to this day. So even though there is so much crap on it, it still holds up. You know, you call it rose-colored, you know, glasses or what?
How Rosamelia colored glasses.
Yeah, yeah. There you go. However you want to frame it.
It's a delightful shade of pink.
Yeah. However you want to frame it, though, people, as much crap as there was, people just care about the greatness, and just more and more people seem to just fall in love with it every day. You know, for everybody who maybe grows out of it, there's always somebody new coming into it. And just,
well, it's the axiom that when you make something that's of a certain level of quality, like there's a reason that games like Pac-Man, Tetris, Space Invaders, you know, Galaga, mm-hmm. where the games themselves are very rudimentary, very basic, they resonate, they continue to resonate because mm-hmm. the mechanics and the fundamentals of the games are fun yeah. and they appeal based on the quality of the play and not the graphics or not the story. And Nintendo had When they hit those pitch perfect games, mm-hmm. it's because not because they look great. When they, some of them look really good, but it's because they're fun to play.
Yeah, I feel like the NES was sort of like the Elvis or the Beatles in the industry. You know, the video game version of that, where it's like they weren't the first, but they were there in such a way that it became sort of like a revolution for a lot of people. And you'll never find a generation that doesn't, young people who've never lived through the NES's lifetime, old people who've seen the whole way through, you'll always find some sort of common ground with the NES, I feel.
Yeah, it's kind of weird to think that there are families that have had a couple generations like grow up in mm-hmm. like play with an NES, mm-hmm. maybe, you know, it's not unthinkable to think that, mm-hmm. you know, a parent played an NES with the kid grew up playing NES, and then the kid had kids, and they're yeah. playing with mm-hmm. the NES, and then maybe we're reaching the point where, you know, their kids are about to have a baby, and, you know, a couple generations are going to experience Super Mario Brothers on mm-hmm. that hardware.
Yeah, that's actually another topic we could even think about. How, you know, when we have kids, are we going to introduce them in the same way that we grew up playing
games? God forbid.
I'm not having any kids.
That's a good episode.
If I have kids, that means that there'll be another person in my condo that'll want to touch my stuff. And that is just not happening.
Well, it's not like any of us would let you have a kid, first of all. But, yeah. You know, hypothetical.
Hey. I was cleared of all charges.
You're on probation, Mike. You're on probation.
What about you, Nick? What is it to be a modern gamer, like the youngest of us here, as an NES enthusiast?
It's weird. It's weird having that being my first thing, like my first real like console. All my game memories are based on that, and then work.
All your game memories are based on that? Oh, sorry.
It's been a long day, man. It's been a long day. Freudian slip. But,
That's what she said.
It's weird to work in the same store where you sell most of those things you have memories based around. That people come in where it's like, oh, I used to play this when I was young, and then people are like, oh yeah, my first game was the Nintendo 64, and I'm like, what the hell's wrong with you? But
and you reach across the counter and you smack the kid with your ring on, like a pimp.
I use the scooter we have over there in the corner, and I beat them with that. That's been there for weeks now, too.
Are you robbing scooters from kids now?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Can stop me?
No. But,
he's always been doing it.
It's great in the fact that I discovered emulation and stuff like that, where I can play these games I always wanted to play. And I know I touched on that before a little bit, but just how many times did I have when I grew up and that was awesome, but I heard about this game, or my friend had this game, but I never got to play it much, or I got to...
Rock and Ball.
I'm not playing Rock and Ball.
You can emulate it. Come on.
I could do many things in my life.
They don't make a USB Rock and Roller controller, though, unfortunately.
Exactly, which is why I can never play it.
Bastards.
I got to play in the performance meant to be played in. So,
I think retro USB needs to get on that.
Yes.
Like, right now.
A retro USB Rock and Roller controller. You heard it here first. So, yeah. So, that's pretty much... You guys have any other final thoughts on
favorite game?
Favorite NES game?
I know
Mike's favorite NES game is Zanac.
Hold on.
Zanac!
There we go.
So is that my favorite game now?
Yes, you lost
it. It came from your microphone.
Mike Markowski's favorite NES game is Zanac.
Zanac!
It's on record for all the world to see.
Just to say one more time, Zanac.
Mike, what company produced Zanac? What was that originally an arcade title?
No, it was MSX. You know, actually, Compile made the game, but I can't remember who brought it over here for the NES.
Probably Konami.
No,
it was not.
No, you lose.
I don't know.
You do not pass go. You do not collect $200.
That's how much Mike loves that. He doesn't know who brought it over here.
I want to say it's FCI.
FCI.
I'm pretty sure it's FCI. All
right.
Fuji sent me.
Something.
You know, I used to manage a Funko Land for many years at Willowbrook Mall, and this is something I wanted to say before we get completely off topic on Nintendo, and I'll share my favorite game after this. I at one point was so visually familiar with the spine labels of NES games, and I'm not as much as I used to be, but after 7 years of managing that fucking store, I used to, from 100 yards... I could...
From 50 paces.
From 50 paces during a duel with pistols. I used to know just by the color and shape of the spine, like, what games we had in stock.
Nice.
And that was, like, I would always be so proud of that, and I would get my employees to, like, test me. I would stand as far as I could in the corner of the store from where the NES rack was, and they'd point to one, and it would be, like, pink and black with, like, a little white outline, and I'd be like... heavy shredding, and like it would be right, and I, you know,
do we have heavy shredding?
Like, here it is, heavy shredding, pink and black with a little white outline. See that? I knew it. I used to be able to do that for any NES game that we would ever have in stock. And my favorite NES game to this day is probably still River City Ransom.
Hell yeah.
It, oh God, it holds up so well, and it is just... In an era where, like, people on the NES were pissing and moaning that Double Dragon didn't have two-player simultaneous play, along came Technos, the same company who produced Double Dragon, and worked out all the flaws of that, gave us a two-player simultaneous game in that kind of Double Dragon universe, but added RPG elements to it, strategy, backtracking, freedom to just tool around. Oh, it's almost a sandbox game, River City Ransom. It's just so phenomenal. It's so ahead of its time, holds up so well. Anybody who hasn't put any time into River City Ransom or never played it at all, if you haven't played it at all, get it, play it. And if you haven't put a lot of time into it, really invest in, like, tooling around, making the money, buying the things in the shops, and powering up your character, and get a pen and pad, like I did when I was a kid, and write down, like, what each thing in the shop increases your karma, your statistics, and make a log and see how much fun that is. It's pretty fun.
Making your own strategy guide,
drawing out your own maps.
That was a big deal.
Paper. Oh my God.
That was a big deal.
Oh, River City Ransom, man. I just get a boner thinking about that.
Gabe?
Actually, one of my favorites is, and it's so hard, Little Nemo.
Yeah.
Such a good game. Have any of you guys ever actually you played it back
played
in the
it.
Day? Such a hard game,
it's
though.
It's ridiculously hard. The music is fantastic, though.
I did.
That's one of my favorite soundtracks.
I got up to the last boss.
Really?
It was down to one hit, me and him. He won.
That was it. Threw your Nintendo out
and
after
the
that.
The same exact thing happened with Bobby Billy, another one of my favorites. Last boss, one hit, me and him. He won. Never got that far again. That was it. But definitely Little Nemo. Such a great soundtrack. The graphics were great. The gameplay was really tight. The whole fantasy element, the colors on it. I remember thinking that was one of the best looking games I had ever seen on the Nintendo back in that era.
And a very interesting choice for Capcom to pull from a classic animation from, you know, turn of the century.
Based on old 1920s cartoons, if I remember correctly.
Yeah.
And then it later became an anime.
Yes, there was an anime.
What came first was...
The anime was long after.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
We're talking, like, some of the earliest animation stuff. I mean, around the Disney era of Steamboat Willie.
Earlier.
Yeah, even earlier. Right?
Really?
Yeah, it was a good, like,
Chester Gould?
I can't remember. I don't think that name is set familiar.
Now I have to look up. I mean...
You have to know.
I have to know. I wasn't...
Quick, to the retrophone.
I was an animator at one point in my.
Wait, so the game came before the anime?
Yes, because the game was not based on the anime.
Okay, it was based
on
the original.
It was based on the original drawings and the story of it.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. Anyway.
So if anything, you could say the movie was based on the game. If all right,
I'll say that my games, I'm very mainstream. So I'm going to go pretty obvious.
Winsor McKay.
Winsor
McKay is the artist who originally created Little Nemo in 1905.
Wow.
Even earlier, 1905.
So again, a very, very interesting choice for Capcom to pull reference from.
Yeah, so I'm probably going to have to say, I'm going to cheat a little bit. I'm going to say Super Mario Brothers 3 or any of the Mega Mans.
Cheer.
Yeah. Super Mario Brothers 3, so you don't steal one of my answers.
Gay.
Did I? No, Mario 3 is Mario 3 is
perfect.
It's,
I think it's
perfect.
It really
it's
is.
A,
I think
it's a perfect game. Yeah. It is undeniably. There's nothing about it. The only criticism that I could ever have about Super Mario 3 is lack of friggin' battery save in that. Nintendo,
it can be long if you play
Nintendo
through all
the gave us something that like and no
well,
password.
Well,
like just
no game's worse than that than Blaster Master. Right.
Yeah, Blaster Master or Faster's Quest, any of those Sunsoft punishing Sunsoft games that start
games
out
right there,
easy enough for you to really get into them, and then they just like ramp up like a spike in crazy.
You have no idea where if you don't know where you're going in Blaster Master, you can walk for hours.
But when Nintendo released Super Mario 3, there was already a long precedent of passwords and battery saves. So like, if you sit down and you're like, get to the second or third world, and you're like, I just don't feel like. I mean,
that's why they have the flute in the game.
I know.
Yeah, but if you want to play through the whole thing, yeah. Yeah. No, yeah. I'm with you on that.
Actually, that's my only criticism. Yeah. Otherwise, technically perfect.
Yeah. So yeah, it's Mario 3 or any of the six Mega Man or any of the six Mega Mans. I have to say all six Mega Mans because I love them all equally. Yeah. I really do.
And I kept trying to think of something else. Like, well, I didn't want to go to like really mainstream answer. Kind of wanted to increase my gaming indie cred. But it really is for me. Mega Man 3 is my favorite NES game. Not 2. And 2 is a great game. Don't get me wrong. It's always a big debate about like 2 or 3 better, but 3 was fantastic. I love the music in it. Mm-hmm. 2 has great music too, but I think 3 dealt with some more abstract themes for bosses and stages, so you can be more creative with that. I think the difficulty was perfect. The design for levels was really creative and a lot of fun, and then later on you go back, you play these warped versions of 4 of the levels, and you fight the bosses from Mega Man 2 and then...
I remember Mega Man 3, what you said about like the difficulty being perfect. I remember beating Mega Man 2 so quickly when I first got it and loving it, but being like,
yeah.
It's over. But Mega Man 3 I did not have that problem with. I remember it was challenging to a point. Now, Mega Man 1, challenge was here.
Yes.
And Mega Man 2, challenge was here. Mega Man 3 was like nice. In a more comfortable position than that. Like, and I do remember being more satisfied with 3 going, well, at least it wasn't so fucking easy I beat it.
Exactly. But no, I absolutely love 3. It's been my favorite of the Mega Man series since I had played it when I was younger. And it still is. So maybe there's a little bit of... prejudice there. I'm trying to think of the word.
Bias.
But
that's racist.
Yeah.
You're a Mega Man racist.
George Bush doesn't care
about
Mega Man.
It's because he's blue, isn't it?
But, no, it's just, for me, like, Mega Man 3 is the perfect... It's the perfect...
I'm going to let you finish. Mega Man 2 deserves to be the favorite game. Sorry. That's totally inappropriate.
That has... What a jackass. Some of my favorite music in it. Sorry. The ending theme is still, like...
I love Sparkman.
For hours on end.
Sparkman's theme.
Sparkman's theme. Shadow Man's theme. It's the best in my opinion. And whoever says Mega Man 2 is better is just wrong. I'm sorry, because we're talking about video games. So my opinion is always going to be right, and yours is always wrong. This is the internet.
What's wrong with the fucking internet? Come on.
Whatever you say, Mister. I was born 5 years after Nintendo.
Yeah. So clearly, I'm the authority. I work in a retro game store. I always know what I'm talking about.
Whatever helps you sleep at night, Nancy.
Pulling my glasses up. I think we're done here.
He's got a new beard stroke. That's pretty good.
No.
So, yeah. Well, thanks for tuning in to another episode of the Digital Press Podcast. We'll catch you next time where we have an all Genesis episode. Just kidding.
Oh, you got my hopes up, you fucker.
I don't like the Genesis. NES is better.
Okay.
Signing out.
Guys, it's Batman!
Not again!
No!